It is the Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt, and it's lame, and it's easy to talk about the weather, but how do you not start with the weather today, Stephen? 60 centimeters of snow in parts of the GTA. It has stopped where I am in Oakville. I don't know if it stopped where you are. That's a no-joke snowstorm.
That is a no-joke snowstorm. This is the call-out the Army. This is the Mel Lastman Memorial snowstorm, right? Bring in the Army.
That's right.
The sun is out where I am, Ben. So there you go. The white hell has passed. I believe the sun will be out for a few minutes now before it sets. So there we go. The worst is over. But if you had nowhere to go, it's kind of cool. Although I didn't have Doug Ford did not come and shovel out my driveway, unfortunately.
No, you were next. You're next on the list.
I had to do it myself.
Once we exposed that, it was a shameless photo opportunity. I think the helping hand stopped. But yeah, you were next on the list for sure, Stephen. The first day of return to in-person learning, rough one for the kiddies out there. My kid didn't have this situation. He just had no school today. But I saw, did you see this? Like, there's some municipalities here in Ontario that, because we all knew it was going to be close to this. I mean, this is probably worst case scenario as far as the actual amount of snow that was dumped. But a couple of days ago, there were some boards of education that already named today a virtual learning day for kids. Is this the death of snow days forever? Now that we know that this is possible, I mean, so we knew we found out during the pandemic we could do these virtual radio shows. So now, you know, you're sick. There's no more sick days. You gotta push through and do these radio shows from home. Now that we know that we can teach these kids at home, like, is this the end of snow days forever?
That is I have not put those two things together, but what a terrible thought. What a way to wreck someone's childhood, right? Now, there aren't that many snow days anymore, but snow days are amazing, unexpected, brilliant things. When you turn on people used to turn on radios. When you turn on the radio in the morning and they say the school, and they go through the list, you know,
right,
waiting for your school to come up, right? Your district. And that moment when they say, no, the buses aren't running here, was the greatest. It was just like a gift from above. If you take that away and just say park your butt in front of your tablet or your laptop because teacher's waiting for you, no, that is not fair. That is a bad, bad thing.
No, in my family, it took more than just the buses being canceled, because my parents, I did generally take the bus, but if the schools were open, come hell or high water or 60 centimeters of snow, if that school was open, my parents were getting me to school. So, yeah, I needed the double whammy, because today was that. It was buses and schools. And shout out to people who I hopefully they figured out the roads. I saw 8 hours. Some people were stuck on the 401. They closed the DVP and the Gardner Expressway. Like, that doesn't happen very often, because, you know, we do have snow plows here. We know how to deal with it. It's not like Virginia, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where, okay, they get the occasional storm. We're used to snowstorms, but nothing like this. I'm not a great Canadian for a myriad of different reasons. Like, I love this country, many aspects of it, but
yes, many aspects.
Many aspects, not all, many. I am on attempt number two in my entire life, building a backyard rink. So I knew this snowstorm was coming. So I got one of these bags. I don't know if you're familiar with this way to build a backyard rink. It's like a big plastic bag. You fill it with water, and then it freezes, and then you cut the bag open, and then voila, you've got a homemade rink, or so it's supposed to act.
Sounds great. Something like a water bed kind of concept.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like a big bladder you fill with water, and it turns into an ice rink. I tried this last year at my in-law's place. Complete nightmare, complete disaster. Not once did my children skate on it, because it was unskatable. It was I don't know what happened. I was incapable of making ice, which should just be water and then the cold, right? Right? Like, am I missing a step there? It's just water and cold.
There's no other ingredient. You're correct.
So how long does it take to freeze ice? Because I did this thing yesterday morning at about 11 a.m. I went out there just before the show, still liquid. Still liquid. Now, granted, some of it is under a blanket of snow, so I'm wondering if that's having some sort of like igloo effect where it's keeping some of the temperature actually higher beneath it. But, you know, 24 hours in minus 5 degree temperature, shouldn't that be enough to freeze ice? You tell me. You're the better Canadian. Yes. You have a home in Newfoundland. You know about ice. You know about water.
I know,
like,
about ice.
What's happening here?
This is a question for a physicist, though, right? This is a science question. This is one of those Mr. Wizard things where how long does it take water to freeze? Like, really, that's a great question. By the way, it's by Wednesday, it's going to be like 4 degrees, so your rink's going to be soup anyway.
Well,
so get them out skating, shovel like hell, and get them out skating tomorrow, because that's it.
Yeah, but then it's back down to minus 10. No, the original theory was, okay, this thing will freeze by at least 24 hours. And then, okay, it's mostly out of the sun, so maybe the surface layer will be a little bit liquid, but the basis of it will be okay. But no, I can't get any of it to freeze. And yes, technical director Derek Brandeo is saying I should talk to Jeff Merrick. I talked to Jeff Merrick last year, and he was of no assistance to me whatsoever. He has, like, some ridiculous Olympic-sized rink mm-hmm. in his backyard. But, yeah, I don't know. If it doesn't work out this year, I retire from making backyard rinks. It'll be an 0-for-2, which I thought was just simple enough. All right, how did you like the first 14-team? Well, I mean, we haven't seen all 14, but 12 teams so far, NFL wildcard weekend, the 7 seeds didn't exactly assert themselves over the weekend, Stephen.
No. Well, first of all, I have to admit that I liked it because there was a lot of it, right? So
yeah.
in the current state of affairs, a lot of football over the course of 3 days is better than less football over 3 days, even if it's crappy football, because it's there. Correct? Like, we agree on that?
That is more a is simple better. Formula, and you're absolutely right. And honestly,
quantity.
It had me rethinking my whole, hey, we got to keep the pool of Major League Baseball playoff teams smaller because, yeah, I'm really going to go against more of the thing I love. No, you're right. More is better.
Yeah, so I didn't turn my nose up at any of it. Let's put it that way. Over the,
yep.
Well, you know, under lockdown, it's... Yes, it's super fantastic. And there's more tonight, which is even better. That's so great. We finish the show up, have a little something to eat, crack a beer, and it's going to start again. Isn't that amazing? And then in 4 days, it starts again. So, that part is really good. There are not a lot of classics. The Dallas implosion, the two things that were most striking. Dallas implosion for a whole bunch of reasons. Not, again, they didn't deserve to win the game anyway, but... Mike McCarthy and everything about Dallas, and I hate Dallas. Like, my father, I inherited this as a kid because, like, my father blamed the city of Dallas for the Kennedy assassination and blamed the Cowboys specifically, and I know they had nothing to do with it, right?
Okay.
Like, there are no conspiracy theories in which Tom Landry's involved, right? But
no.
Specific, right? Like, that was a big, bad day in my family, and a lot of families, and he blamed the city. So... We hate the Cowboys. I still hate the Cowboys. I hate them. Just, it's in my bones, right? And there's no other, it's not like I like anybody that kind of counterbalances where I say, oh, I am a passionate fan of the Green Bay Packers. No, no one in the NFL. I just hate the Cowboys. So watching them do that was extraordinarily satisfying. So there was that. And Mike McCarthy's a disaster. Like he was dragging down Green Bay the last however many years he was there. You know, the only guy who thought he was, you know, had, like, I love the fact that his experience was, you know, Jerry Jones said, well, he's won a Super Bowl.
Oh my goodness.
So he'll get us to the Super Bowl. But he wasn't watching, right?
He's a boob. He's an absolute boob. I don't know if you ever read the Ty Dunn huge expose he did of the Packers under Mike McCarthy and the massages that he was having during the film sessions and the relationship between him and Aaron Rodgers. And then remember, he was hired initially and said, I watched every single play of this past NFL season, and that's what I told Jerry in our interview. And then he was asked, like, after he got the job, he's like, well, not every play, you know, like the important plays. Now, that dude, I remember the there was a nice talking head segment that used to be done back in the Mike McCarthy days. How many Super Bowls would Aaron Rodgers have had under Bill Belichick? And the answer is all of them. Like, he would have had all of them, and Tom Brady would have had none of them in Green Bay.
Yeah, yes, that's true. That's 100% true. So, and again, I know everybody loves Kellen Moore. He's supposed to be a smart guy. He's probably going to get a head coaching job. Yeah, which brings me to another topic. I do want to bring another topic up before we're done. Just remind me. But a quarterback draw with 14 seconds left with no timeouts when you need a touchdown to win on the 25-yard line is an unspeakably awful call. Because the best-case scenario is you get half the distance to the goal line and you spike it with 1 second left, and then you throw the ball into the end zone rather than taking three shots at throwing the ball into the end zone, right?
Correct.
It's an unspeakably bad call. Those extra 14 yards, they're not going to help you that much. You know, Dak Prescott can throw the ball that far. So why would you – or and if you're going to do something, throw the ball to the sideline, take the 10 yards that way, get out of bounds, don't turn it into a crazy fire drill. And, listening to Mike McCarthy protest about, it's absolute. That's what we planned to do, and we worked it out, and we knew, and you know, the umpire got in the way. Like it's just horrible, right?
I love the center acting as if it's recess, right? And he's like, okay, I got the ball, time to snap it. No, there needs to be an official, you know, wearing the footlocker uniforms that needs to actually tell you where you get to snap the ball from. You don't get to just decide on your own.
Yeah, I watched it in real time. I couldn't believe it. I thought, you cannot be running straight up the middle of the field. But I was gleeful again because I hate the Cowboys. the other thing I watched that was the Buffalo Bills perfect game. Never seen
that was a perfect game. You don't get to see that very often in the NFL, but there's an argument to be made that that's the most dominating performance in the history of the sport.
Yeah. Oh, you 7 for 7, you know, two missed extra points, but we spent while you were at Parts Unknown last week, we spent a lot of oxygen talking about, you know, the Bill Belichick and the two games that the Bills and the Patriots played. And, the Bills looked way better in the second one. But, you know, Bill Belichick's a genius, and they're going to have a plan. And, you know, it's going to be cold. But so it has never happened before, right? It has not, any way you want to measure dominance in a football game, that is the single most dominant performance you're ever going to see. And it was just jaw drop. Even though it was a blowout, you had to keep watching just to see, you know, at some point, are they gonna have a fourth down at some point in this game? Are they gonna have to punt? Are they gonna have to think about it? Or are they just gonna?
They didn't even have a third down they had more touchdowns than third downs at one point in that game.
Yeah, it was mind blowing. They weren't rolling over like they're rolling over a team that hit the wall for the last five games of the season and had a bunch of injuries on defense and, you know, certainly weren't going to score their way out of something. But hats off. You know, that's Buffalo's super full value for that. And they're going into Arrowhead. That's, you know, I don't care what happens the rest of the playoffs. That's the game.
Yeah. No, that is. And that was, the Bills, their entire offseason was built around beating the Chiefs, and they were able to do it during the regular season, which was like their high watermark when everybody had them winning the Super Bowl, and then they kind of went into the toilet for a bit, including a loss to the Jacksonville Jaguars. Man, there's been some weird teams that have lost to the Jags this season. It feels like we did this a lot during this NFL season where we thought things were not the way we thought they were supposed to be, and it was a long season, so maybe that the longest in the history of the sport, but all of a sudden we're at a place now, Stephen, I think where things make a lot more sense. Like the Bills look like the Bills, specifically offensively, they look like the Bills. In fact, the running game doesn't look half bad either with the way Devin Singletary's come on the last few weeks. The Kansas City Chiefs look like the Kansas City Chiefs, and maybe even better than previous editions of the Kansas City Chiefs, because remember the defense was horrible and Patrick Mahomes was turning the ball over early this season. I think it was interesting to hear Chris Collinsworth talk about his conversation with Patrick Mahomes about how when he started taking what the defenses were giving him, he noticed that the Chiefs' defense was actually playing a little bit better because they weren't on the field as much. They didn't have the quick strike offense. They were a little more it took a little bit longer to get down the field, which meant these drives were a little bit more sustained. The Bills and Chiefs was the matchup that we got a season ago, which, it was the Bills' first time in this incarnation in an AFC championship game and didn't look up to the task. It was the game that we anticipated going into this season. I didn't know we'd have both teams rolling on all cylinders like we have right now, but you couldn't have a better circumstance for these two to have a rematch.
No, it's hard to imagine that the winner of that game isn't going to beat whoever wins the Tennessee-Cincy game. And whichever of those teams wins.
Even with Derrick Henry?
Even with Derrick Henry. I just think they're both too good right now. Kansas City started a little slowly offensively in that game, but that Pittsburgh defense is really good. Pittsburgh offense is god awful, obviously.
Yeah.
But the Pittsburgh defense is really good, and look what they did to them eventually as that game rolled on. And we already talked about the Bills. So that is stunning. Now I have two little things I have to rant about on the NFL before we go on to other things. Okay. One thing, because I know a lot of people, I know some people were number one in that Pittsburgh-Kansas City game because it was a blowout. We had to spend, for an hour listening to them talk about what a great guy Ben Roethlisberger is.
Yeah, that's rough.
There's some evidence that he's not a great guy. You can look it up, kids. Anyway, that was number one. Number two, a lot of people noted the Jim Nance and Tony Romo having trouble making the pivot from the 60 Minutes promo about the new evidence in the as to who betrayed Anne Frank and then going right back into a football game and not really being able to hit that note right. I'm not sure who could have hit that note right.
That's a rough one, man.
They hit it really wrong. But the bigger, this is the one no one else seemed to pick up on, so maybe it's just me. But on the Fox broadcast, on the panel, which, can be amusing. So they started into a subject which clearly they shouldn't have done, which was the fact there's only one African-American coach left in the NFL after all the firings, and started to deal with how do we fix this problem. And the two oldest white dudes on the panel, Jimmy Johnson and Terry Bradshaw, started going on about how the real issue is you need black owners. Or black general managers or black owners. Now, the problem with that logic is that it suggests that well, what it says, it suggests something that's probably true, which I guess is that white general managers aren't hiring black coaches because they're black. That there is bias, or that black general managers or black owners would hire coaches because they're black. But in either case, the kind of implicit racism in that, as they went down that road, was, Kurt Menefee did have to jump in at a certain point and say, white people, a white general manager could hire a black coach. A white owner can hire a black coach. There's nothing preventing that. But I thought, boy, you want to know what's kind of wrong with the people? Because, that attitude permeating that league, they thought they were doing the right thing. They were saying something really progressive about how, boy, we just need more black ownership, which would be a great thing. And more African-American general managers, absolutely. And in a league that's 80% African-American, but to say that, if that's what we need to solve this problem, because, clearly all these white guys who run teams and own teams aren't going to hire black people. I thought it was jaw-dropping. So anyway, there's my rant. I'm done. Let's talk about football.
Yeah, no, you know what? We'll come back around and talk about football in the next segment. We'll talk to Sal Capaccio, and, we'll talk more, even more football at 6 o'clock when we talk to Solomon Wilcots. But, no, I appreciate you bringing that to light. But, I'm glad Kurt Menefee at least was the voice of reason. I will say, as we wrap up this portion of the NFL conversation, I will now put you down for two professional sports franchises that you're on record as hating, both for various nonsensical reasons. There's some sense to the second one, I suppose. Actually, there's some sense to both of them. But the Cowboys now join a list of two that is also the Red Sox are on that list. Do I have that right? Is there anybody else you would like to throw onto that list? Cowboys, Red Sox.
I'm not sure there's anybody else that's right there. No, I think those are the big two. No, those are absolutely the big two. The teams that I actively root against. Yes.
Yeah.
Those are I hate watch them. Yeah. Those are the two. And it's in both cases, it's somewhere deep in, I don't think my father hated the Red Sox necessarily. So I can't blame him for that one. But yeah, the Cowboys one. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Anybody but. And you know what? It's great. This era has been particularly satisfying. Because they get close, and people are halfway through the season, people are, here they come. How about them Cowboys? And then
I have the stat of all stats here in regards to Cowboy Schadenfreude. Playoff wins in the last 25 seasons: Jake Delhomme, 5; Trent Dilfer, 5; Mark Sanchez, 4; Brad Johnson, 4; Colin Kaepernick, 4. Dallas Cowboys, 3. They have fewer playoff victories over the last 25 seasons than Mark Sanchez. That's all that needs to be said about the Dallas Cowboys. And yes, there is a very much a direct parallel to the Toronto Maple Leafs, but yes, that you're not shedding any tears over that. I don't think you're shedding any tears over Novak Djokovic going to Qatar, I think, is where he went, and then eventually he's going to go back to Serbia. You know how I know
back.
That you're interested?
No, he's back home. What? No, he's done his Heroes return to Belgrade.
Okay. And I'm sure he was feted upon touchdown there. But you wrote about this. This is a big deal.
Did.
Stephen Brunt on Sportsnet.ca wrote about this. There's now, I thought it was pretty shocking, as you eloquently put it on your piece, that someone of this magnitude that has enjoyed this much has been given so much as a professional athlete and has had people bend over backwards to be at his service, was actually sent out of the country. It took a long court battle. I never thought that they would ban him for 3 years, but that appears to be what's happening. And it also appears that France is going to be the next country to enact a similar law, which would bar him from the French Open. This could be the end. I mean, will it happen in Great Britain? Are we going to have Novak Djokovic's Grand Slam record remain tied with those two others because he cannot play in another one?
I would color me skeptical on that part of it. The thing is, and I did return to column writing. I'm not sure how often I'm going to do this because I kind of retired from column writing a while ago. I used to do it four times a week, so I've kind of done it. But I was inspired to get up on Sunday morning and write about Djokovic. You know, you can't blame him. You can't blame these guys for the privilege that we gift them with, you know, like the reason that they're treated like gods and that they are allowed to behave differently than normal folks and have a different kind of responsibility or lack of responsibility, or the fact that they believe that the rules don't apply to them, is because we let them, right? We're the people that build the pedestal that you put them on. So it's kind of, you know, it's like the Antonio Brown discussion, you know, like how dare, why would he think he could get away with that? Well, because he could, right? Until he couldn't, because we let him get away with it because we just talked about football for 25 minutes, right? Like that we create the privilege. These guys exploit the privilege. So, you know, sometimes you got to look in the mirror a little bit, is all I'm saying, and saying, you know, who, you know, we create the heroes here, and I mean we in terms of fans. Like,
yeah,
we invest our time and our money and all of that stuff. But yeah, in terms of what happens now, like the decision in Australia in the end was clearly a political decision by a government that is coming up for election that is not popular. You know, there's not a government in the world, I don't think, that where the citizens think they did a good job with COVID. Right, everybody thinks their government did a god awful job. But, you know, they took a very hard line originally. They locked down the country. They locked down people. They, you know, Australians couldn't get back in their own country for a stretch. And, you know, people are mad, and I get it, and frustrated. You know, look around. People are mad and frustrated. So it was an easy political decision, you know, whatever the technical fine points of it were, to say no. Because that could basically override the regulations. And, you know, look, and again, it would appear that if he indeed did test positive for COVID when he was back home, which is, you know, I'm not sure what I bet on that one, but he, you know, clearly flaunted whatever restrictions he was supposed to be under, paid no attention. So there's all kinds of reasons where you just stomp on and say, you know, that's it. But and right now it's like, you know, from a political point of view, it's like I remember talking to Bob Arama when the Ali. This is a weird comparison, but when the Ali Ernie Terrell fight was thrown out of Chicago, and it eventually turned into the Ali Shivalo fight in Toronto in March '66 because Harold Ballard wanted the money, and you know that's all he cared about. But the government of Ontario let it go. But Aram told me that for a stretch there were countries coming out, like jurisdictions coming out of the woodwork, saying they would not host the fight because it was a draft dodger. And he said, well, it wasn't like we're going to go put it in Idaho, but Idaho stood up and said, we will not host this draft dodger. It's sort of the same with Djokovic now. Like, everybody's going to jump and say, us too, you know, because our people are mad. And look what we're doing. We're going to punish Novak Djokovic because you're all mad about COVID. You know, when by June or late May, when French Open happens and presume maybe things are better and you know, maybe things have calmed down. Like, look, he'll at a certain point, the world being as it is, he'll be let in. You know, are we going to let him into Canada in August to play the tennis tournament in Montreal? Do we have a rule that would keep him out? You know, because now he's had COVID in theory.
Right.
And I know, I think that gets you in. The indignation is real and understandable, and the political stuff is, but the political stuff's a bit knee-jerk, even if you're on that side, and I'm on that side. I'm glad they threw him out. But, you know, I think in the clear light of day down the road a little bit, we'll see this for what it was.
Yeah. And it, I guess, opens up the field for some Canadians. I saw Rafa Nadal win his first match yesterday. But, I think we're done talking about Novak Djokovic. We probably wasted too much air talking about him over the last couple of weeks or so. But, yeah, I hadn't spoken to you since I've been back. And since you wrote that piece, again, go check it out on sportsnet.ca. When we come back, though, they are still celebrating in Western New York, including Ryan Fitzpatrick, former Bills quarterback, who I believe is still under contract by Washington, was at the Ralph on Saturday, shirtless. Was there shirtless cheering on his former team?
He's a Harvard man, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Harvard man shirtless in Orchard Park in January. How often could you write that sentence?
Not all that often. So we'll talk to Sal Capaccio, Bills beat and sideline reporter for WGR 550, about the Bills and their triumph and whether Ryan Fitzpatrick is trying to run for mayor there or something. The Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. And it's not very often you get to embarrass Bill Belichick, and never like the Bills did on Saturday with a 47-17 victory over their division foes in the wild card weekend. Let's talk to Sal Capaccio, Bills beat and sideline reporter for WGR 550. How's it going, Sal?
Pretty good, guys. Hope you're staying warm and safe. All the snow here, there, it's crazy.
Yeah. No, it absolutely is crazy. I have not left the house today. So, yeah, I'm doing all right. Shout out to the people on the roads right now. So, I mean, the Bills, you know, they made that AFC Championship game last season. But that was one of the most dominant displays of football, maybe in the history of NFL playoff football. And it came against Bill Belichick. Can you put that moment, that game, in perspective in franchise history? Because it felt more than just a first-round victory for a team that has Super Bowl aspirations.
You're right about that. It was, absolutely. Look, I will tell you, I grew up here. I went through the Super Bowl years, and I went through, obviously, the drought and the domination of the Patriots through the 1990s. It's one thing to win a game like that. It's one thing to win a playoff game. It's one thing to end your season in a playoff at home, which nobody wants. But in that situation, against that team coming to Buffalo, it was just so magnified. I cannot overstate what it meant to this organization. The scar tissue that was built up from the dominance of New England for 20 years over the Buffalo Bills. And even though the Bills won the division last year, they went to New England this year, they pounded them the day after Christmas, basically, and the way Josh Allen played. All of that would have kind of even been erased because New England could have said, see, we gave you your 1 year, we're back on top. You had to do it in this situation. You had to put the nail in the coffin and deliver the knockout blow in the playoffs. They finally did. And really, the demons were exorcised, is what I would like to say about this particular team and the way they dominated the Bills.
Yeah, you know, so I was watching the game, and I covered those the Super Bowl, the Bills Super Bowl years, and I was thinking, there were some dominant performances in the playoffs in that stadium. I remember they blew out the Raiders 1 year. I don't know if that was an AFC Championship game. I'm trying to remember. I remember when they beat Montana when he was quarterbacking the Chiefs. Like, there were some dominant performances, but I think part of the difference, and you're right, part of the difference is it's Belichick and the Patriots. The other thing is, during that run, those 4 years going to the Super Bowl, you came to expect it. Like, you understood that the Bills were the best team in the AFC. They should have won a couple of those Super Bowls. But this is kind of the moment. And again, I know people know this is a good team. I know it was a playoff team last year and went to the AFC Championship game. But this, to me, was like, you know, in front of those fans in a full house, this, you know, the kind of acknowledgement that this might be the best team in football we've got
right in front of us now. Like, that's what it felt like to me from a distance. I wasn't at the stadium this week. I've been there lots of times. Like, what was it like? What was the feeling, you know, again, on a cold day in Orchard Park? I know exactly what that's like. But to be, you know, with that crowd and the team playing that well, like this, you know, that it's got to have been a special 3 hours there.
So let me go back, since you referenced it. Let me go back to the first Super Bowl that year, 1990. The Bills go to the, you know, they 88, they win the division first time in a while. They lose in the AFC Championship game against Cincinnati. 89, they lose at Cleveland. Then in 90, they come out, they just have a great year. They go to the playoffs, and it was the same thing. Remember how the Dolphins had dominated? In case your listeners don't know, mm-hmm. the Dolphins were the dominant force over the Bills in the 70s and most of the 80s. And they had to play the Dolphins in the playoffs that year. And it was the same kind of comp of this year against the Patriots the other night, which is you had to deliver the knockout blow. And they did that. They did that in that season, 44-34 in the snow. Kelly Marino was great. Then they go on and they have to play the Raiders the next week. And I'll tell you, being in this stadium Saturday night, I was in the stadium that day when they won 51-3. I was a senior in high school sitting in the upper deck with my buddies. And it was very similar in this regard. There was no angst. Guys, this was a complete domination from start to finish. That it was a party in the stadium. Like, once the Bills once it was 14-0, no one thought the Bills were going to lose. There's 70,000 seats. None of them were being used. Everyone stood the entire game. And it was literally a party the entire time in the stadium, where you felt, I would say, almost relaxed, knowing we got this. Like, there's no way this team with this rookie quarterback is coming back against this defense. And the same thing happened in 1990. 41-3 at halftime. I remember chants of thank you, Bills, yeah. And thank you, Ralph, through the whole second half. It was very similar to that.
Yeah, one of those guys not using a seat, not using a shirt, was Ryan Fitzpatrick, who, I think is still an employee of the Washington football team. I mean, what is this guy's MO? I know he's beloved, but he's beloved in a lot of places, including Tampa, right? Remember, he used to show up at those press conferences with the chest hair billowing out and the big chains and the sunglasses. Is he just going to travel around to his former fan bases and you know, get some good screen time here? What's going on with Ryan Fitzpatrick in the crowd on Saturday?
Oh, no. He may be beloved by those fan bases, but he does not love the fan bases there as he loves the Buffalo Bills. Guys, when he was the quarterback of the Miami Dolphins, the hated Miami Dolphins, he went on a podcast and they said, of all the places that you've played, that's your favorite place to play. Where is it? And he said, I know that I'm a Miami Dolphin, but I got to say Buffalo. Like, he said that while he's a member of the Miami Dolphins. Like, he is absolutely loved. And by the way, his best friend is Eric Wood. Eric Wood is the former center of the Bills. He's my colleague on the Bills radio broadcast. He was there. Ryan brought his kids to the game. Not all of them. He's got a lot of them. He brought a couple of his kids to the game, I believe. He came up in the radio booth and he said hi. He loves the Buffalo Bills. He loves the organization. It just, when you get here, you know, there's an old joke that says, Buffalo will make you cry twice. Once when you realize you have to go there, and then once when you realize you have to leave. Because once people come here, they never want to leave. It's just such a great city. It's a warm environment for people, notwithstanding the weather, right? Because it's just such a family-oriented place. And Ryan Fitzpatrick loves it here, and he roots for the Buffalo Bills, even though he's a member of Washington football team, apparently.
That's awesome. I love that. Sal, it's kind of hard to say, you know, what do you take away from a game when a team plays almost the perfect game, you know, a perfect offensive game anyway. But, you know, looking ahead to, you know, Arrowhead and Kansas City and a crazy great matchup, it's coming a little early in the playoffs, but my God, it feels like that could be the AFC. That could be your preview of just about anything. You go as far as you want. You know, this Bills, it's been a funny season. You know, they had that dip in the middle. Like, you know, it's hard to look at that team on the weekend and say, yeah, those are the guys that lost 9-6 to Jacksonville. But what do you take away from that, except kind of tip your cap and say that, you know, that was complete and, you know, almost perfect?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the way they're playing right now and all systems go. You take a look at the dips that they had this year. You lose 9-6 to Jacksonville. They rotated wins and losses for a long time. And, you know, coincidentally, it came after they beat the Chiefs on Sunday Night Football back in October, right? They go to Kansas City. They beat the Chiefs handily 38-20 that night. And there was a lot of talk about how they just geared up all offseason for that game. And that was their Super Bowl, kind of, to make sure we beat them. That means they're going to have to come to us in the playoffs. And I think I'm not going to say they lost focus or took their foot off the pedal, but something happened where I think that, you know, it went into cruise control a little bit too much, where, you know, it was almost presumed that, okay, now we're going to play this team on our turf once the playoffs come, but you can't do that in the NFL. And they go through the ebbs and flows, and now the Chiefs then start to play better, and the Bills don't, and now here we are where the Bills have to go and play there. But over the last several weeks, a couple things have happened, guys. First, it started with stopping the run better, and that's Harrison Phillips and Ed Oliver, who are both playing the best football of their career, and they've done a nice job. The teams can't just come in like Indy did and say, oh, we're just going to go and run the ball against this team. The Bills are much better at stopping the run and forcing teams to have to put the game in their quarterback's hands. And the second thing that happened is the other side of the ball and running the ball. The Bills have found a run game. If there's a difference between the Bills now and a year ago when they went to Kansas City in the playoffs, it's the Bills are a much, much better running football team outside of Josh Allen. And that's by handing the ball to Devin Singletary, who's become the lead back. They're averaging 165, 170 yards a game the last 5 weeks or so. They have the threat to run the ball, and teams have to respect that. They cannot just say, you know what, you're not going to run the ball. We're just going to load up and stop Josh Allen and those weapons. And because they're running the ball so well, it's opening up more of what you saw on Saturday night and using all those weapons.
I mean, it's easy to point to a singular moment in the season, really, for this team, and that was the second half of the Bucs game in Tampa, right? And they end up losing that game in overtime, but they were down so big early, and they run this late the rest of the way. It's not like they were facing the best teams in the NFL after that. But they looked more like the Buffalo Bills that we had seen before, as you mentioned, the bye and that Chiefs game. Well, they looked pretty good in Tennessee before the bye, after the Chiefs game, but in a loss. I mean, is there any reason for that? Like, have you had any anecdotes about some halftime speech in Tampa? Because it felt like that was kind of the turning point to returning the Bills to what they were early in the season.
Yeah, I don't know of anything one specific at halftime, but I agree 100%. That's exactly right. That was the turning point of the season. And you know what's funny is I remember being down in Tampa that day and that week, and we have family down there, so we spent a couple days down there. And I remember watching on the Zoom calls the next day, it's Sean McDermott, and it was almost like he even recognized it. And I'm not going to say he was in a really good mood after a loss, but he basically said, like, you know, I really like the way the team responded. I think that, you know, we found who we are a little bit. You got that sense that, okay, this team might have – they came up with something, whatever that formula was. Let's remember, though, this was coming off, too. You know, they had the win game the week before that and all that. They were in a little bit of a rut here, right? So they had a lot of things kind of going against them, but it felt like they were just climbing out of that hole. I will tell you, that also coincides with giving the ball to Devin Singletary a little bit more, letting him become more of that running game and saying, we're not going to do this whole running back by committee thing. We got to be a little bit more committed here. And guys, as you know, in baseball, football, whatever it is, when someone's getting limited opportunities, when they get those opportunities, they try to hit the home run ball. Well, I think Devin Singletary was doing that earlier this year. Yes, he had a very good yards per carry average, but he also was getting stopped for losses and in the backfield because he's trying to make everybody miss on one play to get a home run to say, give me the ball more. Well, guess what? He doesn't have to do that anymore. He's confident and comfortable knowing I can get 3-4 yards. I'm still going to be on the field and getting the ball the next play. And I think that's mattered a lot in this situation.
Yeah, I can't wait to see them play the Chiefs in a rematch of, well, earlier this season. And, of course, the AFC Championship game a season ago. Sal, great stuff. Thanks for doing this, man.
Anytime, guys. Thank you very much. Stay warm. Stay safe.
All right, you too. Sal Capaccio, Bills beat and sideline reporter for WGR 550. Yeah, I know. This is going to look so stupid if they lay an egg in Kansas City at Arrowhead next week, Stephen. And there is like an element of you do need to pump the brakes on the team that looks absolutely otherworldly 1 week because it is such a week-to-week sport, such a week-to-week league. But it just – for a team that – like Sal said, made an AFC Championship game a season ago. Like, Josh Allen doesn't have that much more to prove. That felt like an exercising of a demon's type of win over their hated rival.
Yeah. Oh, look, this isn't a team that's come out of nowhere. They were really close last year. They had some wobbles this year, but look, I don't think they might lose. They might lose in Kansas City, Ben, but I don't think they're going to lay an egg, right? Like, I think we've seen enough. There's just too many good things going on there.
Yes. Hopefully there's good things going on in Blue Jays land right now. There's actual Blue Jays news today. Now, not the 40-man roster, not the guys that you know, but there have been 18 international free agents added to the Blue Jays since the international signing window opened on Saturday. It's freezing and it's snowy here. I assume conditions are better where Andrew Tinnish is vice president of international scouting and baseball operations for the Toronto Blue Jays. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going well. No snow here in Juan Dolio, Dominican. I can report that, thankfully.
That's good. That would, that would definitely make the news. So, yeah, 18 of these international free agent signings. Like, I've done some reading on some of them, and the catcher is where the big money is. But what can you tell us is the highlight of what we've seen here in the first couple of days of the window?
Yeah, I think that, certainly this is, for us, a top-heavy class with the catcher, Luis Meza, from Venezuela, a kid who we've had our eye on for probably the better part of 3 years now, a kid who we think can be a very solid two-way player. You know, just one of these guys who, every time we saw him, whether he was facing 85 or 93 miles an hour, whether he was facing, you know, big breaking balls or hard sliders, he always hit. And, you know, that's obviously the main ingredient, right? It's tough to get to the big leagues if you can't hit. And that's probably the tool that stands out most for him. But he's a very athletic, flexible catcher. A kid who comes from a baseball family. And just a kid that we're really excited about. Obviously, we signed a lot of players. And it's a pretty diverse class, mostly between Dominican and Venezuela. And look, these kids are so far off, but I think the important thing is that every one of these players that we find, there's something that our scouts see in them that gives them hope or belief that these guys have a chance to get to the big leagues. And obviously, you know, you guys know, we know that the reality is most of them won't. But, you know, the way we present it to the players is like, look, we believe in you guys. Like, there's something here that we believe in with you guys. And we're going to put you in position to be successful, but you guys have to grab it. You guys have to go out and work and grab it. So we're excited. Yeah, we're excited. Start of a career for a bunch of these guys.
It's a cool time, kind of dreaming on these guys, Andrew. I'm wondering because Meza, as you say, is a Venezuelan. There's a bunch of Venezuelans on your list. And this is a bit of an aside, but like that's a tricky place to do business right now. You know, getting in and out of that country. Like, how do you? What's it like for you scouting on the ground? You said I know you have local scouts there, but how tricky is it to kind of follow a prospect in Venezuela to get in and out of the country to kind of do what you know, it's pretty easy to do in a place like Venezuela or in the Dominican where, you know, there's none of those complications.
Yeah, certainly there's a lot more challenges, but the first thing I'll say is that our guys on the ground do an unbelievable job, getting us from A to B. And thankfully, I really haven't had any issues there at all. And we've been able to, you know, get around to places like Caracas and Maracay and Valencia, in and out of airports successfully. And our scouts really do a good job helping us get around. I will say this. I just got back from Venezuela. I'm in DR now, and I've spent the last 4 or 5 days in Venezuela. And, you know, things, at least from my perspective, and of course I'm not living there, I'm not there on a day-to-day basis, but from my perspective, things have changed since the last time I was there, which is just before the pandemic began, back in probably January of 20. Things are better there now, safer, seemingly, you know, maybe a little bit more access to resources. It's obviously not where they want to be. It's such a beautiful country, great people, great baseball players, and a place that I love to go, and a place where there's just a lot of good baseball talent. So it's not easy. It's not something where you just kind of pick up and say, you know, hey, I'm going to just jump on a flight and go to San Domingo and, you know, get with one of our scouts and move around. There's a little more planning involved. But for me personally and for our staff, our domestic staff who spend time down there, fortunately, you know, we haven't had any issues, and you know, I think again a big part of that is a credit to our guys on the ground. We've got six scouts on the ground there who just do a really, really good job taking care of us, getting us from A to B, and getting us in front of the players that, you know, that we need to see.
I think, Andrew, a lot of fans are very familiar with the way the Major League Baseball amateur draft works, and you know they pay attention to who the Blue Jays draft. But quite often, some of the better players end up joining Major League Baseball franchises through this means, and including Vladimir Guerrero Jr., especially for a franchise in the Blue Jays position here, where you don't expect to be drafting at the top half of the first round. How important is getting the international signing window right for this franchise in its phase of development?
Yeah, it's really important. You know, in a given year, when you look at, you know, opening day rosters or 40-man rosters, I'd say that typically you're looking at, you know, maybe 25 to 30% of the players come from this market. You know, obviously the bulk of players come from the draft, but if you split high school and college up, I mean, really looking at the international market is almost like looking at the high school market through the draft. So it's a significant chunk. And, you know, to this point, not having a draft, it allows teams, whether they win 100 games or lose 100 games, to be competitive with who they feel or who they've evaluated as the top players. It's a totally different world. It's a little bit of the Wild West. I would say that the international market, there is truly that sort of diamond in the rough, so to speak, that I think still exists, where, you know, in a couple of years, maybe even less, you may find that a player that you signed for $10,000 or $20,000 is much more valuable than the player that you signed for $1 million. You know, it's a risky market where, you know, in the draft, you know, you take a college kid in the first round and you've got maybe 3 years of college and 500 plate appearances or more, you know, plus some summer experience. Even the high school kids, you've got a little bit more showcase data from the summer and their summer high school circuit. Like you don't get that in Latin America. Plus they're, you know, in the year they turn 16, so they're so far off in their prime. So, I mean, look, we really rely on our scouts to get to know the players inside out. And look, it's a leap of faith with a lot of these guys. It's a leap of faith. But you try to put together your process, and every team has a different process, and every team has success in different areas. And, you know, we feel pretty good about our approach. And, you know, time will tell. You know, you can't be afraid to take chances. You can't be afraid to be aggressive down here.
No, that's for sure. And you guys have had some great success recently. A guy who finished second in the MVP voting in the American League was acquired through this process. Andrew, appreciate the time. Enjoy the warmer climbs.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Andrew.
See ya. Andrew Tinnish, Vice President, International Scouting and Baseball Operations for the Toronto Blue Jays. And there are, like 16-year-olds. That's what we're talking about. Not everybody's 16 on this list, but you're talking about, I mean, Vlad Jr., I think he was 17 when the Blue Jays signed him. What was it, like $2 million? Maybe it was a little bit more than that.
Three, I think. Yeah. And the thing is, it's not, the thing is, when you identify these guys, they're not six. Like, it is a bit of the Wild West, right? Because everybody's equal going in on these guys. And you don't draft them, you build a relationship. So by when the clock turns and they have their birthday,
right,
it's funny how everybody knows who they're going to sign with, right? So it is, but as I think Andrew alluded to there, it's the one place, right? Look, in terms of the amateur draft, I'm guaranteeing you that everybody's evaluations of every player are just about the same, right? Because everybody's seen them, there's lots of tape. But down there, you know, there's a lot of players and the street agents, and you might stumble on a 14-year-old or 13-year-old kid that nobody's seen before, and you might see him differently than somebody else does. And it's not like he's playing in a league or a college league or a high school league or anything like that. It is so different. But it's a place where the value of old school scouting is still really high.
Yep. Well, and the Blue Jays had the smallest signing bonus pool of any team. Them and the Dodgers, I think, had the lowest because of the free agents that they signed, but they didn't use all of it on their big signing. The catcher, Luis Mesa, went for just over $2 million, and they had over $4 million to spend. So keep an eye on him. We'll see him maybe in 5 years. But yeah, he's a kind of sort of a member of the Toronto Blue Jays. When we come back, we'll talk to Solomon Wilcots, former NFL safety, host of the Opening Drive on Sirius XM NFL Radio, as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.